my main response to the world is not one of anger. As I get older, I find it's one of disappointment. One of disappointment.
I was so disappointed by the events of the day.
Everybody will be so disappointed.
I'm very disappointed.
Hi, I'm Wendy, and you're listening to So Disappointed, the podcast that asks you about some of the things that have really let you down. Disappointment comes in so many forms. Maybe you've been disappointed by a film or television franchise, or an artist you admire, a political figure, an ideology, or just the human race in general. The permutations are endless. We'll be looking at why we get so invested in people and things to such an extent that we get angry when they let us down. Why do we care? What's wrong with us? What's wrong with them? In this episode, we'll be discussing an artist whose forthright opinions have, for many, tarnished his reputation beyond repair. In this episode, we'll be discussing Morrissey. In August 1992, the much-loved British pop group Madness performed two sold-out shows at Finsbury Park in London. It was a big event, as Madness hadn't appeared together in public since splitting up in 1986. And so, to mark this special occasion, they organised a mini-festival featuring some of the artists they admired. Artists such as Ian Dury and the Blockheads, and former Smiths frontman, Morrissey. But Morrissey's performance that day was, to put it mildly, a PR disaster, and the beginning of the end for many of his fans. Why? Here's some context. The Smiths were one of the most important indie guitar groups of the 1980s. Their music spoke to, and for, the sensitive outsiders, the arty weirdos, the shy, anxious, clever kids who felt disconnected from whatever it was the stifling mainstream world demanded of them. Morrissey's erudite lyrics made those kids feel better about themselves. It's okay, you're not wrong, you're not alone. He was a poet, a rebel, a hero, a defiantly non-macho, dry-witted iconoclast who despised Thatcher and the monarchy. A devout vegetarian, too. He was on our side. Well, and yes, you knew there'd be a well coming here. By the time of Madstock in 1992, 5 years after the Smiths imploded, Morrissey's character was already in doubt. Some highly dubious comments he'd made in the music press, plus troubling solo songs such as Bengali in Platforms, Asian Rut, and the National Front Disco, had hoisted a big red flag. Was Morrissey a racist? When questioned, he'd always insist that those songs were actually anti-racist character studies. They'd been completely misunderstood, but deep suspicion persisted. So when he appeared on stage at the Madness gig, wrapped in the Union flag against a large backdrop of skinhead photographs, that was the last straw for so many people. This seemingly sensitive artist, who meant so much to his adoring acolytes, was now wallowing openly in far-right iconography. People felt angry and confused. They felt betrayed. And that was just the start of it.
I think the thing about right-wing stuff is you can't really play with it. You can't experiment with it. You can't dip your toe in it because it's such a wicked ideology. And you've got to be very, very careful if you get anywhere near it. And I to this day, I don't know if it was that he was genuinely trying to go in a skinhead direction and go in an NF direction, or if he just thought that he was really clever and he could get away with it in a way that other people hadn't. But to be standing up in an audience of that containing an awful lot of skinheads, waving a union flag, having been singing songs about how people from Bengal don't belong here, is sending a very particular message.
This is Carrie Marshall, a musician and writer from Glasgow who once adored the music of Morrissey and the Smiths. Her story echoes that of all those fans who regard him as a vital, formative influence.
One of the things that the Smiths really connected with me over was that this was music for outsiders, and Morrissey's persona was the ultimate outsider. This is the person who would, you know, be at home with a very clever book rather than being invited to any parties. And looking back on it now, he was so, so queer. And that definitely resonated with me as well. So this was the artist who was perfect for you as an awkward queer teenager, because he was expressing what you were feeling. And that feeling of being seen, that feeling of being represented in the music that you're listening to was incredibly powerful. And I think that's one of the reasons that from pretty much day one, the Smiths fans were so fanatical and so obsessive in many cases. It's because this felt like really important. It felt that this really mattered in a way that an awful lot of other music didn't.
Morrissey was never out as such, was he? Not publicly, at least.
I think Morrissey was fairly typical of the time, in that there was quite a lot of artists who were queer but wouldn't admit it, but kind of hinted at it very, very strongly. And, you know, Morrissey was having fun with it. You know, when he got lines, you know, like, he took me behind a disused railway line. I mean, the comedy of that. But also, there's a real yearning quality that Morrissey has, and particularly in the early Smith stuff, it's a real feeling of wanting to be a complete person and not necessarily feeling able to be a complete person. And at the same time, he sings quite a lot about various forms of experimenting with people and how it's pretty disastrous. And, you know, the young me could definitely relate to that.
Those infamous comments he made about black music during interviews in the 1980s, that was when alarm bells started ringing for a lot of people. They were pretty shocking. For any listeners who may be unaware of what it was that he said, can you fill us in?
Right about the time of The Queen is Dead. In fact, before that, it was 1984, he made the comment, reggae is vile. And that was a very Morrissey thing, because his kind of deal was being against pretty much everything in the mainstream. He's much more interesting than that. But then in 1986, he did that interview with Melody Maker, and he was asked specifically about his feelings about black music and whether, for example, Panic, with its singing about hanging the DJ. And he went on a lot, and he basically said that all black modern music is awful. The music that they made was vile. The black music doesn't say anything whatsoever. And, you know, this is not just being waspish. This is not just giving good quote. This is not a great worldview. And this is when the shine started to come off him. But for me, it was the infamous NME thing, where they started asking questions around about late 1988 with Bengalian Platforms, which was on his first album, first solo album, Viva Hate. And that's got the lyric that, you know, life is hard enough when you belong here. And, you know, if you followed Morrissey's career, words are what he does so, so well. You know, so he's very good at putting ambiguity in songs about sexuality and songs about lived experience. But if he wants to be precise, he has got the power to do that. So he can't have been unaware of the possible interpretations of that. And that's when questions started to get asked in the music press about, well, what are we dealing with here? What is this guy really representing? And that led on to the infamous Finsbury Park gig where he was supporting Madness, when he's, you know, waving the Union flag on the stage. And I think for a lot of people, and certainly for me, that was people kind of woke up to what was going on with him.
And people, fans, weren't just appalled by this stuff, were they? They felt let down, betrayed. Morrissey wasn't who we thought he was.
And I think what really hurt about that for an awful lot of people is he was supposed to be better than that. He wasn't, you know, one of these horrible, gormless right-wing musicians that we had no shortage of in the 1980s. He was one of ours. He was our guy. And I think that's much more disappointing when you had that connection than if somebody started off being appalling from day one. I think it's quite an early example of something we've seen again and again and again in the social media era, which is the ego that cannot handle criticism, the person that cannot admit they were wrong and that they have made a mistake, and they double down. And there's a fairly famous cartoon that does the rounds from time to time, which shows a man getting criticised for saying something that could be a bit racist, and he deals with that by shaving his head and getting a swastika tattoo and saying, "You made me do this." And we've seen this happen so, so many times in recent years. And I think that is a big part of it, because if you read his autobiography, it's borderline unreadable, because it's just settling scores for hundreds of pages. And it's a bit... I think it's quite representative of how he sees himself compared to other people. I think he really does think he is better than everybody else. And how dare anybody criticise him or suggest that he's in any way less than perfect. And a lot of the stuff he said has been pretty bad. And, he can be coming from a reasonable place. So he's always been a very strong advocate of animal rights and against, you know, the slaughter of animals. But in that context, he called the Chinese a subhuman species. And again, that's not being clever. That's not being sharp-tongued. That's crossing a line. And, you know, it's opening a big old box marked racism.
The quote Carrie referred to there comes from a Guardian interview Morrissey did with the poet laureate Simon Armitage in 2010. An animal rights advocate, Morrissey thoughts turned to China. That quote in full.
Did you see the thing on the news about their treatment of animals and animal welfare? Absolutely horrific. You can't help but feel that the Chinese are a subspecies.
We are, for obvious reasons, being extremely careful in this podcast to quote Morrissey directly and accurately. This next quote comes from an interview he did for his own website, Morrissey Central, in 2018.
As far as racism goes, the modern loony left seems to forget that Hitler was left-wing. But of course, we're all called racist now, and the word is actually meaningless. It's just a way of changing the subject. When someone calls you racist, what they're saying is, you actually have a point, and I don't know how to answer it. So perhaps if I distract you by calling you a bigot, we'll both forget how enlightened your comment was.
That same year, 2018, Morrissey endorsed the far-right party for Britain, led by the anti-Islam activist Anne-Marie Water. In an interview with Tremor.com, he said,
"She believes in British heritage, freedom of speech, and she wants everyone in the UK to live under the same law. I find this compelling, because it's very obvious that Labour or the Tories do not believe in free speech. I mean, look at the shocking treatment of Tommy Robinson."
That's true blue patriot Tommy Robinson, real name Stephen Christopher Yaxley Lennon, one of Britain's most notorious far-right extremists, whose criminal record includes convictions for violence, harassment, stalking, fraud, and illegal immigration. Morrissey is also supportive of the self-styled man of the people, far-right politician Nigel Farage. In another interview for Morrissey Central, again his own website, this one conducted in 2019 by his nephew, Sam Etsy-Rayner, he said,
"It's obvious that he would make a good prime minister."
In that same interview, he also said,
"If you call someone racist in modern Britain, you are telling them that you have run out of words. You are shutting the debate down and running off. The word is meaningless now. Everyone ultimately prefers their own race. Does this make everyone racist?"
Anne-Marie Water, Nigel Farage, and Tommy Robinson. These are the people Morrissey now aligns himself with. This is the Britain he wants. Over now to our resident psychologist David Myers for further elucidation. David, we all have people we admire. Artists whose work speaks to us, moves us on a deep, fundamental level. So it stands to reason that their, shall we say, transgressions can sometimes be more than just a little disappointing.
So when one of your idols does or says something which challenges your worldview, it can really profoundly affect you. You can feel abandoned, you can feel rejected, you can feel hurt. You try and find things which speak to you in some way. You know, it comes down again, I think, to adolescence being an intensely confusing time. So if you find music, groups of people, art, actors, actresses, sports people who you really identify with for one reason or another, then you start to form an attachment to that person and the things that they do. But also I think that the more important thing there is the attachment between the individual and the person that they're idolizing. So everybody likes to have a hero in one way or another. We all have people who we look up to. Usually that's our parents, but I think for some people we may be psychologically more driven towards looking for a role model from outside the family for whatever reason. And obviously the stronger that sort of relationship becomes, it becomes what's known as a parasocial relationship, which is a one-sided psychological relationship formed between, these days, like an audience member and some kind of celebrity. It's very one-sided in the sense that you're unlikely to meet the person who you're idolising, but you feel a sense of intimacy to them, a sense of connection. And I guess if you strongly identify, say, with a musician, you might feel that they're writing songs which are in some ways written for you or about you. You'll develop that kind of closeness in an even stronger way. If you're a teenager and you're kind of grappling with your own sort of insecurities and aspirations, and then the person you're looking up to does something which either threatens that or turns a situation on its head by doing something or saying something which you viscerally disagree with, you're going to feel that. It's going to feel very, very personal, very painful. You'll feel rejection, you'll feel hurt, you might feel quite lost, actually.
The author and pop historian Justin Lewis was 13 when he first heard The Smiths in 1983.
I really liked them, but in a weird sort of way, I had to kind of separate the artist and the art quite early on. Because what happened was, and this would have been early 84, I think it would have been, I started to read interviews with Morrissey. It always seemed to be Morrissey. It wasn't the other members of the band at all, really, for reasons we now understand, I think. But I would occasionally see him interviewed on TV or whatever, and he just rubbed me up the wrong way completely, I have to say, from that early on. I didn't think he was particularly funny. He just had this way, and I know some people were charmed by this at the time, of being this sort of curmudgeon at the party. And I didn't really get it, to be honest. I don't mind curmudgeons, but I never thought he was quite funny enough for that to really come off. And I know there will be people possibly screaming, saying, well, he was one of the wittiest people in music. Although, you know, people would often cite lyrics that he'd written, and it then transpired that they were, you know, things he'd borrowed from a film, or, you know, I hope Sheila Delaney got a cut in the long run of lyrics and things. But I can pinpoint the moment, really, that I went off him. It was February 84. He was reviewing the new singles for Record Mirror, which admittedly wasn't a particularly great selection of singles that week. But he was clearly in the sort of mood of this is beneath me sort of way. And in fact, the page didn't say reviewed by Morrissey. It was rubbished by Morrissey because he didn't like anything, really. And while it would be ridiculous, I think, to pretend to like things when you don't like them, there's a real offhand way to the way he did it. The effect was, it was a bit like a cross between someone's great-grandfather clutching an ear trumpet and stamping on the floor, and a bored adolescent whose voice hasn't quite broken properly yet. So I was off on the wrong foot with him a bit, really.
Earlier in the episode, Carrie alluded to an infamous interview Morrissey did with Melody Maker in 1986. The recently released Smith single, Panic, with its recurring Hang the DJ refrain, prompted the interviewer to ask Morrissey about his thoughts on dance music, and black music in particular. Before we go on, let's hear those salient quotes in full.
Ultimately, I don't have very cast-iron opinions on black music other than black modern music, which I detest. I detest Stevie Wonder. I think Diana Ross is awful. I hate all those records in the top 40. Janet Jackson, Whitney Houston, I think they're vile in the extreme. In essence, this music doesn't say anything whatsoever.
He also said, with regards to Top of the Pops and its then-producer, Michael Hurl,
I don't think there's any time anymore to be subtle about anything. You have to get straight to the point. Obviously, to get on Top of the Pops these days, one has to be, by law, black. I think something political has occurred among Michael Hurl and his friends, and there has been a hefty pushing of all these black artists and all this disco-fied nonsense into the top 40. I think, as a result, that very aware younger groups that speak for now are being gagged.
Justin Lewis.
And even at the time, I remember thinking, not only this is nonsense, but that's quite a disturbing allegation, because it's a very arrogant assumption to claim that black pop music has nothing to say about anyone's life. I think it now, and I thought it then. It's such a reductive and ignorant thing to say. And apparently there was some talk after it was published of him suing the Melody Maker, and then, of course, nothing came of that for some reason. And I carried on warily enjoying the records, knowing full well that he was capable of spouting this kind of garbage in interviews. I just think, just more widely, I think he became a little too comfortable at being interviewed, at being this kind of sage of pop. It's a very dangerous position to put anyone in, because you start to make these people believe that they're a misunderstood genius. I think in a way he's damaged, awful word, but he's damaged the brand, because the Smiths are now something that you almost have to apologise before you say, well, I quite like them, actually.
As Justin says, separating the art from the artist is something we all have to deal with sometimes. It's a recurring theme in this podcast, and it's a complicated, nuanced conundrum which varies from person to person. The person in this particular case is writer Juliet Jones. Our producer Paul and I interviewed Juliet in a flat in the south side of Glasgow. You can hear noisy birds and barking dogs in the background. Just ignore that. It's a really good interview. Here's what Juliet had to say.
Well, I first heard of Morrissey when... do you remember those Now compilation tapes?
Yes.
Yeah. And he was on there with Suede Head. And that was the first time I'd ever heard his name. And I liked the song Suedehead. But then I kind of forgot about him for a good few years. And when I was 17, just about to go to university, I bought, and I can't remember exactly why I did this, I bought the Best of the Smiths, or the Greatest Hits. And I remember taking it on CD, and I took it home that night. And it was thrilling, it was really thrilling. And I just thought, you know, his voice is amazing, and the songs, and it's a night I'll never forget. So, I mean, that's the two sort of main poles of my finding out about Morrissey and really getting into the Smiths.
Over the years, you would have become aware of some of the controversies that he was involved in. Did that affect your enjoyment of his music?
A friend of mine asked this question on Facebook about 5 or 6 years ago. And of course, it was relevant probably years before then. And I remember people kind of going, yeah, you can easily sort of separate the art from the artist. I remember saying something like, well, it's easy for us to say because, you know, we're white, you know, we've white British, and I think it would be a bit different if we weren't. All the stuff that he's said politically is not something that anything that I agree with or anything that I can sort of defend really or justify. I've been thinking about this, and my love for Morrissey is hard to explain. And I think maybe that night that I took the Smiths CD home and I listened to it, it was just so entrenched that the political stuff for me hasn't been forgotten, but it's just been maybe compartmentalised in my mind. And again, I can't justify it in any way, but it's quite a rare case where I separate the art from the artist, because usually if an artist, a filmmaker or such does something dodgy and not nice, then I find it quite difficult to watch their films or listen to their music. So,
but in this case, it's because the music means so much to you.
Yeah, it's hard for me exactly to know, but I think it's that, and it goes back to that night the day of me taking the CD home from John Menzies in Inverness High Street.
And what about the music he makes now? Are you still someone who's interested in what he does?
I mean, yeah, I don't kind of rush out to listen to the newest Morrissey record, but I'm quite bad at listening to new music altogether. I was just talking to a friend before you came round, and I was saying, oh, I'm listening to Morrissey and I'm listening to The Fall on vinyl. And he said, you do know that new music, other music exists, right? I would say, in the best way possible, he's quite stuck in the past. And he's a huge fan of Morrissey and The Fall. So I thought, if he says that, then maybe I should get to listening to other stuff. I wouldn't really rush out to listen to the latest Morrissey album. When he played a concert here in Glasgow recently, I tried to get a ticket, but I couldn't. My partner went, and he came back and he said it was a really good gig.
And did Morrissey say anything untoward?
No, I think he was trying to crack jokes about Glasgow, and they fell a bit flat.
And when he does another interview and he comes out with one of his opinions, do you ignore it or do you just roll your eyes?
Yeah, I remember when he said the thing about, is it right that he said that he would vote for Nigel Farage? Yes. Yeah, I did. I wasn't happy. I think by that time, sort of in my mind, he's gone past the point of redeemability in that way, where I can justify in my own head the stuff he says. So it was just another kind of thing. I was disappointed, and I didn't want to look too deeply into it because I thought maybe I was a bit scared that I would go off him if I did that.
But is it important that you like him?
Yes,
personally?
Yes it is. And this is the thing that confuses me, because his political opinions are pretty awful and I don't agree with any of them. And it's difficult for me to know what's made me still like him, really, over all these years. And yeah, that's a good question. Liking him as personally as I can is important. I've always liked lyrics and the fact that he's been open about having struggles and depressions and things. And obviously the rest of the band, the Smiths, were just incredible.
You're talking about that reminds me, I was very young, like I was about 11.
Yes.
And I heard Thriller for the first time, the whole album.
Yeah, yeah.
And I still feel that in my body.
Yes, yes. It's like muscle memory, isn't it? I don't know if that's the right phrase, but yes, it's very all-encompassing. And it's like, it gets into your bones. Yeah, yeah, for sure.
It's really hard to let that go.
Yes, it is. Yeah. It's like sort of osmosis, and it really gets into you as deep as it can. And that's... And maybe I feel like if I kind of let that music go, then a part of me would go as well.
You have been listening to So Disappointed. It's written, edited, and produced by Paul Whitelaw and Wendy Jordan. That's me. We'd like to thank our guests, writer and musician Carrie Marshall. You should read her brilliant book, Small Town Joy, From Glam Rock to Hyperpop, How Queer Music Changed the Sound of Scotland. Justin Lewis, his latest book is Into the Groove, the 1980s, the ultimate decade in music. It's out in October 2025. Juliet Jones is a freelance journalist and radio DJ. We'll link to her work in the show note. Morrissey's quotes were read by actor Sprite Kirkwood. Our theme song was mixed by Daniel Frame. And if you liked the show, please tell your friends. Tell your sworn enemies. Tell the person next to you in the supermarket queue or at the bus stop, and leave us a review. It really does make all the difference. Find us on Blue Sky at So Disappointed and on Instagram at So Disappointed Pod. Our website is sodisappointedpod.com. Please reach out to us today and share your disappointments. In our next episode, we're taking on the most disappointing year of all. 2016.
David Bowie, Ed Stupot Stewart, Paul Daniels, Cliff Mitchellmore, Nancy Reagan.
Because the year Frank starts Finley, with, you know, Bowie Alan and Terry Wogan in the first month.
Ronnie Corbett,
and then there's Prince and Victoria Harry Wood Hines, in April, Parker consecutive Lee, days, I think. Jordan, and I thought to myself, say about heroes. Those are two examples there of people I would have said were heroes of mine when I was a teenager.
Tony Warren, Gary Shandling,
but
Victoria Wood,
mm-hmm, apart Leonard from Cohen, Carrie Fisher, Andrew Sachs, David Bowie, Gene Prince, Wilder, mm-hmm, George
Caroline
Michael,
Mahern,
Muhammad Ali,
good lord,
Carla Lane, Prince, Jimmy Young.
I think one of the things that I found interesting, Robert Vaughan, is that it seemed very Palmer, obvious that Bert Trump Pope, would be elected.
Peter Schaefer.
I was sitting in front of a computer, obsessively Vaughan, hitting refresh as Jack the states Agabella, were called. I just
Rabbi
went, red,
Lionel
red,
Blue,
red.
Liz Smith, Rick Parfitt, George Michael, Carrie Fisher.
I do need to say, I meant none of the words that I've just said. I was quoting Morrissey. I keep wanting to say Moriarty, but that's a different British arsehole.